Good morning, I'm Chris Oakes, and coming up today, the Declaration Decoded, helping the youngest Americans understand and appreciate the meaning and ideals of our nation's founding document. Also this morning, to reduce waste and fraud, Medicaid recipients will soon be required to prove that they are working or prove why they can't in order to be eligible for benefits. What do those federal mandates mean for low-income Ohioans? And hot summer reads and cool July programs at the Findlay-Hancock County Public Library, Sarah Clevidence will tell us what's happening. This is the Good Mornings Podcast Edition for Wednesday, June 24th, 2026. This may be this day's news of most lasting significance. I just love that turn of phrase that the late Paul Harvey was very fond of. This day's news of most lasting significance could be this. Brain blood tests will soon be coming to help diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The FDA has given the green light for the marketing of the very first in vitro diagnostic device that tests blood for plaques that are linked with Alzheimer's disease in adult patients. Neurologist Dr. Richard Isaacson says this will revolutionize the way dementia is diagnosed and will work similar to how cholesterol tests are done. And they're pretty routine. And this will be much the same. Experts estimate 47 million Americans have preclinical Alzheimer's disease and are not yet showing symptoms. And like anything, we don't have a cure for Alzheimer's, but like most anything, the earlier we catch it, the more effective treatment can be. And this is huge news. So when this next time you go to the doctor, sometime in the future, you go to the doctor and they draw blood for an Alzheimer's test, you can say, hey, I heard it here first. Heard it here first. Pretty amazing stuff. By the way, speaking of your health, this was kind of interesting. New research shows that many adults are improving in their health as they age. Now, I know the typical thought is that we have declining health as we age. We get older. You know, we get the aches and pains. We get the, you know, the medical issues that start to pile up, right? Well, a study done by Yale University shows close to half of adults age 65 and older actually had improvements in cognitive function, physical function, or both as they got older. Nearly half. Researchers looked at 11,000 participants in the Health and Retirement Study, a federally funded survey of older Americans. Becca Levy, the lead author of the study, says many people equate aging with an inevitable and continuous loss of physical and cognitive abilities. But the study found that improvement in later life is not it's not the exception to the rule. It's actually very common. Close to half actually showed improvement. We think of a decline as we age. No, we get better as we age. At least some of us do. Now, the big thing in this will be figuring out why that is. Why do the half that have improvement as they age have that improvement? What's driving that? And what's driving the decline for those that fit in? So I'm guessing that that's part two of this study, or it should be. Maybe that's the next step in this, but very interesting. So if you are, you know, getting up there in years, as I am, and you're thinking to yourself, well, that physical and cognitive decline is inevitable, think again. May not be the case at all. This is important science here. Among the first things you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day, this is very important to know, because here is more information, misinformation, that is, for whatever reason, spreading like wildfire online. And this is a series to come into the summer months. Apparently, TikTok influencers are promoting dangerous anti-sunscreen messaging. They are claiming, the claim is that people can build up a solar callus, a tolerance to sunburn, and that antioxidant-rich foods can replace your traditional sunscreens. So you can build up a tolerance, and the food you eat can protect you. Nope, sorry. These creators, mostly young people, are falsely arguing that sunscreens contain harmful chemicals while promoting natural alternatives like beef tallow and other non-scientific methods. There's no scientific evidence to this. So when you see this online, know that it's quackery. That's what we used to call it back in the day. Back in my day, that's what we called it, quackery. Now we call them online influencers, but they're just quacks. They make the claim that our human ancestors never used sun protection. Well, no, they didn't have that sort of ability, and they paid the price for it. But anyway, the influencers claim that natural sun exposure is not harmful because our ancestors never used sun protection. I think they probably would have if they could have. You know, the other thing that our ancestors did, they walked around in the summertime in, formal dress, the long sleeves and the jackets and the coats. And I mean, they had very little of their skin was actually exposed. They didn't walk around in shorts and T-shirts like we do. So there is that. Medical experts emphasize that the sun does cause sunburns and does cause skin cancer, regardless of diet and gradual exposure and all of that. No. Sunscreen, play it safe. Don't listen to these online influencers. Just pass that along. It seems weird that we have to tell people that. That sunscreen is... I would think this would be settled science, but apparently not. This is kind of interesting science. You talk about summertime traditions from millions of people around the globe. Fireflies been a big part of the magic of spring and early summer nights. I mean, who doesn't have memories of collecting lightning bugs in a jar when they were kids, right? You run around the backyard and collect all the lightning bugs. But if it seems like there are fewer of them than there used to be, it is not your imagination. Scientists say some firefly populations are in trouble. It's enough for the Firefly Specialist Group of the International Union for Conservation of Nature to label 18 species. Now, there are like thousands of different species of fireflies, and really they're not flies at all. They're beetles. But 18 species of them are now being labeled as at risk of extinction. Now, other scientists say that may be overstating it, and evidence so far is mostly anecdotal, but they are at risk, and there are fewer fireflies out there. Now, thankfully, that is not because children are suffocating them in those sealed jars. Inevitably, you wake up the next morning and all the fireflies would be dead. Didn't matter how many holes you poked in the lid of the jar. But that's not why they're dying out. Yale University researchers say urban sprawl leads to habitat loss, and artificial outdoor lighting interferes with their reproductive cycle because the reason they glow is so they can attract a mate. But when we have so much outdoor lighting, and apparently LEDs really interfere with this, the mates can't find each other. So artificial outdoor lighting is a big problem. Other factors include the use of pesticides, widespread use of pesticides, and water pollution, since many species of lightning bugs reproduce in water, kind of like mosquitoes. And water pollution is, preventing them from spawning, I guess. Anyway, I thought it was interesting because my wife and I were just having this conversation the other day. Our son told us he was going to take the girls out to the backyard and collect fireflies like we did when we were kids, right? And that got us onto the conversation that there just don't seem to be as many as there used to be. As it turns out, that is true. And lastly, here among the first things that you need to know, the most interesting and buzzworthy stories of the day. Speaking of going outside, and a very elusive celestial event is expected to peak later this week, is according to astronomy experts. But then again, maybe not. The June Bootids are considered the most unpredictable meteor shower in the universe because of its history of surprise outbursts of activity. According to space.com, in 1998 and 2004, there were unexpected outbursts of activity, but then a forecasted meteor shower in 2010 did not happen. So it may happen, it may not, but if it does, it will be high in the western and northwestern sky during the evening between now and Saturday. So if you are so inclined and you're out chasing the fireflies anyway, look up. You may see the meteor shower or not. And if not, there are other upcoming meteor showers later this summer. The Southern Delta Aquarids and the Alpha Capricornids will peak at the end of July, and the Perseids meteor shower, which is forecasted to peak in mid-August, according to the American Meteor Society. So, anyway, but there may be a meteor. Don't be surprised. Don't count on it, but don't be surprised if you see shooting stars in the sky later this week. There you go. Some of the most interesting and buzzworthy stories to get your Wednesday morning started.
WFIN News, I'm Matt Demchek. Your WTOL 11 weather. Partly to mostly sunny today with a high pushing 80, partly cloudy tonight, low in the 60s. The Ohio Department of Transportation says Interstate 75 northbound at State Route 103 in Bluffton is restricted to the left lane through Friday for bridge deck repairs. Get more on this and other road projects in the area in this story on our website. The state of Ohio didn't fare too well in a new economic impact study.
The Commonwealth Fund report states that the Medicaid and food assistance cuts that go into effect in January from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act will cost the Buckeye State more than 50,000 jobs and remove $5.3 billion from the state's gross domestic product by 2029. Healthcare will suffer the greatest losses. SNAP work requirements and a down hiring market further exacerbates the problem. Rural residents will also suffer.
ONN's Jay Fox reporting. Finley High School Show Choir, Finley First Edition, will be holding its annual garage sale fundraiser at the high school. FFE says the garage sale is the group's biggest fundraiser of the year, and proceeds go towards competition fees and the purchasing of costumes and other items necessary throughout the season. FFE points out that there are new dates for the garage sale fundraiser this year. You can drop off your gently used items June 27th through the 29th at the high school. The early bird sale will be on June 30th, and then the garage sale will be held July 1st through the 3rd. Get more details on Finley First Edition's annual garage sale fundraiser in this story on our website. The city of Fostoria is partnering with the Ohio EPA to provide a free tire recycling day for residents. The city says thanks to funding received through the Ohio EPA Recycle Ohio grant, Fostoria residents can dispose of unwanted tires at no cost while helping keep the community clean and protecting the environment. The tire recycling day is on Saturday from 8 to 10 a.m. at Foundation Park. Get more details about it in this story on our website. Remember, you can always get more news anytime at WFIN.com.
Well, coming up here in about a week and a half, Americans will unite, or hopefully unite, for the semi-quincentennial celebration of our nation's 250th birthday. But how much do you really know about the original founding document of the United States, the Declaration of Independence? Even more importantly, how much does the next generation know? History and American government professor Katie Kennedy explains it line by line in her new book called The Declaration Decoded. And Katie, I know this is a book that is aimed at middle grade readers, but I'm thinking even some of us adults could probably use a crash course as well.
Well, we think so too. And we tried to write it so that it would be accessible to younger, and not little kids, of course, but you know, 10-year-olds, 12-year-olds, but also not written in a childish way so that adults can enjoy it too, can touch base back again with some of these important documents from our nation's founding.
Yeah, because I can remember, and I don't know if kids have to do this anymore, but I remember back in when I was, I think sixth grade or something, we had to memorize the first paragraph and a half of the Declaration, everything from when in the course of human events to the right of the people to institute new government. We had to commit that to memory. And I remember that to this day, but the thing is, while we memorized the words, we never really fully grasped the meaning, and that's really what you do in the book.
Yeah, absolutely. So the language is not intuitive to us anymore. It's not really accessible, both because it's political theory, and that's inherently a little bit stiff and a little bit hard, right? But also simply the passage of time. We just don't talk like that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the decoding the language and then also placing it in this context, explaining what had happened before, what Thomas Jefferson was talking about, Thomas Jefferson wrote the draft of the Declaration of Independence, and then the Second Continental Congress edited it very heavily and made him really quite irritable. Nobody likes to sit there and hear their colleague. We had to sit there and listen to this for 2 days.
You bring up such a good point that it's not quite Shakespeare, but obviously it's not the way we talk these days. So part of it is just having people understand, you know, what the words actually mean. And, you know, we get so caught up these days, especially in the Constitution. Why is it so important for all of us, but especially young people, to understand, to truly understand the Declaration?
Right. So the Declaration, of course, came first. The Constitution is the highest law of the land, but it was written after the United States existed, a few years down the line. The Declaration did not create American independence, but it announced it to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a sort of America's first and most important document of resistance, of protest. It's the embodiment of our political principles. And it contains some of the most beautiful lines ever written by an American, probably the most beautiful lines that were not written by Abraham Lincoln. It's a reminder in this age where we tend to simply post mean things about each other on social media, and sometimes the government governs by mean posts on social media, that we do have principles. It is possible to speak with passion and with eloquence, and that we can undertake dangerous and difficult things. The people who signed this were risking their lives in a real and immediate sense. So while it's a document of protest, it's also one of hope. They would not have done this if they did not have hope for a better future.
Yeah. What are the biggest misperceptions or misconceptions that people have about what the Declaration says and what it is? And you say that a number of these misunderstandings actually even impact civic life today.
Yeah, so people think that the Declaration has the force of law, which it does not. It has the force of poetry and principle, but it does not have the force of law.
Mm-hmm.
And they confuse it with the Constitution, which, of course, is the highest law in the land.
Right.
The Constitution being the we the people one, the Declaration being the when in the course of human events one, if you remember.
Mm-hmm.
But the Declaration is important for its ideals, for its aspirations, for what it says about us as a people. Historian Pauline Meyer called it American scripture, which I think is a great phrase. And Abraham Lincoln called it the electric cord that binds patriotic hearts from one generation to another, that bound the hearts of the Civil War generation to the generation of the founders and binds our hearts to theirs, across generations. I think it's a beautiful, beautiful idea.
And how big is the challenge in taking all of that? Because, again, these are big ideas. These are big, bold ideas, really high concepts, and then kind of whittling that down to make it accessible for today's young people.
Yeah, part of the issue, of course, is the language, as we said. But part of it, too, is that even in 1776, people didn't always know what Thomas Jefferson was going on about. He structured the document. He did a great job, but not that Thomas Jefferson used my praise, you know, but he did. He starts by invoking the right to revolution, goes into 27 grievances against King George III, and it ends by invoking the right that he set up in the first paragraph. And then in what I think is really quite beautiful, that last line, you know, our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honors, he turns to the men sitting next to him in Philadelphia and kind of gives them a sober nod. He would not have had to do that, but he does, understanding that what comes next may be death. But even so, this is a moment for heroism. Mm. And I think that's really beautiful. But Jefferson was, you know, he was not trying to explain things. He was trying to justify things.
Yeah.
And so there's a little bit of a difference there. And so the weight of those 27 grievances, even though colonists and now new Americans didn't necessarily understand them all, taken together, they made them really angry. And that's what Jefferson needed.
Mm. You know, for all of the weighty subject matter, this is not without its lighter moments. There are some fun facts in here. For example, you say that there is one word that was probably a typo in the Declaration of Independence.
Yeah, either that or a printer having a little bit of fun. I always thought that unalienable rights was just a tiny bit clunky, you know, but who am I, right? But Jefferson actually wrote it the way I thought he should have. He wrote inalienable rights. That's in his draft.
Hmm.
And then after Congress spent a couple of days debating it, they cut 25% of his draft. They cut the 28th grievance, which was a condemnation of the international slave trade. And so there are only 27 of Jefferson's original 28 grievances and so on. But that went through Congress. That word, inalienable rights, made it through Congress's edits. And they sent it off to the printer, and it came back as unalienable. Just whether the printer simply made a typo, or that's what he was used to using and just didn't notice it, or he decided to edit Jefferson like everybody else. That's what we now have.
So, obviously, predating spell check. And to that end,
yes.
you know, we talk about making all of this relevant for a modern audience. What is the, at the end of the day, the biggest idea from the book and how it should shape the way we think about this historic 250th anniversary?
I think we need to remind ourselves that we have political principles, you know, that we are a nation of laws, not of men, that we are a nation that has not always met our ideals, but we've always tried to meet our ideals, and that we do have ideals, that all men are created equal, that there is no such thing as second-class citizenship. That's what the colonists were rebelling against. They were being treated in ways that a British citizen in London or in Edinburgh or Oxford could not have been treated, and they knew it. Their rights were being violated. The idea that the government exists for the people do not exist for the government. So just a reminder of our past and of what we stand for, I think would be worthwhile.
Amen to that. Again, Katie Kennedy is author of The Declaration Decoded, just in time for America's semi-quincentennial. Katie, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Over 760,000 working-age Ohioans with lower incomes are enrolled in Medicaid. That represents more than 6% of the state's population. Beginning next year, they're going to have to prove that they are working or prove why they can't in order to remain on Medicaid. While the goal of preventing abuse and misuse of the program is admirable, many doctors are worried about the ripple effects. Dr. Amanda Nizam is among them. She is an oncologist at the Cleveland Clinic. Dr. Nizam, what are the new Medicaid work requirements, and when do they begin in Ohio? I know the federal rules, now these new federal rules say they have to be in place by the first of next year, but some states are rolling these out early. So what's the deal in Ohio?
Hi, Chris. Very nice to join you, and thank you for having me. So these requirements that require 80 hours of monthly work, education, or community service for the ACA's Medicaid expansion population are slated to go live on January 1st, 2027, as you said. So this Medicaid covers 1 in 5 non-elderly adults newly diagnosed with cancer, 2 million individuals with a history of cancer, and as you stated, about 776,000 in Ohio specifically. These disruptions will ultimately impact thousands of patients nationwide, especially when it comes to cancer-related care.
Now, your immediate concern is for those patients who are already in active treatment. How could they be impacted?
Yes. First of all, patients, when you are cancer patients, don't have time to wait. They are already in treatment. Seeking to prove that you are working is a full-time job in itself. Being treated for cancer is also a full-time job in itself. So an 80-hour monthly work requirement, that ignores a severe physical toll of cancer treatment. And nearly three-quarters of patients with cancer already missed work due to their diagnosis because of treatment schedules, transportation, visits, and it leaves little room for steady employment. A lot of these patients have to be on either disability or short-term leave of absence from work. And the cancer treatments themselves cause quite a bit of side effects that can impact quality of life and really interfere with the ability to be fully present and able to work. So states that expanded Medicaid actually see lower rates of advanced stage cancer and fewer cancer deaths. And that's because stable coverage helps people get diagnosed earlier and stay in consistent treatment. So to go back to your question, that is ultimately the most important thing. Gaps in coverage mean delayed chemotherapy, missed screenings, or postponed surgeries.
Supporters will argue that that's why there are exemptions carved out for situations just like that. But you say that carries its own set of difficulties, as you were touching on.
Correct. The eligibility verification is shifting to every 6 months, and that's increasing the risk of accidental coverage drops during active treatment. And we know that applying for and getting all, going through all the bureaucracy of getting all the paperwork to prove that you are exempt is a full-time job in itself. Like I said, being treated for cancer is a full-time job already, and having to navigate the bureaucratic loops of paperwork and going back and forth to physicians, that is a huge burden for the system, not only for patients, but also for medical care providers. And it could drastically result in disruptions in coverage because it's required every 6 months now.
And I'm sure that you have seen this happen from time to time, that a cancer patient will lose Medicaid coverage, even temporarily. What, in your experience, happens when that happens?
Yeah, so if a patient loses coverage, even just for a few weeks, just because of a simple paperwork error, it becomes a huge ripple effect. So chemotherapy gets delayed, prescriptions, people miss prescriptions, surgeries are postponed. And for a patient with cancer, these administrative delays, they're not just inconveniences. They can actually lead to irreversible disease progression and directly impact whether a patient survives or is eligible for further therapy.
You make the point that this isn't the first time that lawmakers have tried to tie Medicaid benefits to work requirements. What was the result previously, from your vantage point? What did you see?
Yeah, so we have clear evidence from past state rollouts showing that work requirements create massive procedural churn and a huge bottleneck. So, for example, when Arkansas previously imposed work environment or work requirements, roughly 1 in 4 people subject to the mandate lost their health coverage. The vast majority of those individuals, they didn't lose insurance because they were no longer eligible or because they found steady jobs. They lost it because they couldn't navigate the complex reporting requirements and documentation to get their medical exemptions documented in time. So we can't let history repeat itself for patients with cancer.
Well, and that's what I was going to ask next. Does this measure do enough or really anything to address some of those shortcomings from the lessons that hopefully were learned?
Well, no. So the states have the ability to implement specific administrative processes that can mitigate coverage loss while remaining within the bounds of the federal CMS guidance.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things that states can do is they can use existing electronic health data and medical billing claims to automatically verify and apply the medically frail exception for anyone with a confirmed cancer diagnosis, bypassing the need for redundant paperwork entirely every 6 months. And then when automatic data matching isn't possible, then states states must provide a clear single-step pathway for patients to easily confirm their status without disrupting care. Second, state agencies can also establish streamlined pathways that recognize the role of family care networks, ensuring that reporting requirements do not disrupt the stability of the household. But really, automation of these verification systems and cutting unnecessary red tape is how the states can still adhere to these federal CMS guidelines while keeping the primary focus on continued coverage for patients who need to be covered.
Because, again, the goal is to prevent abuse of the system and ultimately for people to become part of the workforce where they will have other health coverage options when that is possible. And that's not a bad thing because reducing the cost protects the viability of Medicaid for those who do need it. You mentioned some of the options that are available to the state to streamline this process. Are there other policy changes that could protect vulnerable patients while reducing administrative burdens and yet, again, working toward that ultimate goal, which is laudable?
In addition to streamlining exemptions via existing data, I would say not overburdening caregivers and then protecting the care infrastructure. So Medicaid reimbursement is already way behind. Forcing oncologists to spend precious clinical hours is you know, takes time away from taking care of many patients and could reduce oncologist participation in Medicaid entirely. I think really focusing on the automatic verification based on diagnoses would help because then you're not subjecting patients and caregivers to the, you know, bureaucratic bottleneck that can disrupt care.
Yeah. And again, just to clarify, we're talking about this in the context of oncology care, cancer care, because that is your specialty. But this would, by extension, apply to other conditions, other patients as well. Again, Dr. Amanda Nizam is an oncologist at the Cleveland Clinic. Kind of breaking down the flip side of these work requirements here that'll be taking effect at the beginning of next year for Medicaid recipients. And Dr. Nizam, thanks very much for taking the time sharing your perspective.
And Chris, sorry, to go back to your question about what other things they can do, I think we also need to look at, even if the intent is to, you know, look at this from an economic perspective, the math doesn't work out for complex care. So when administrative tracking bottlenecks causes a patient with cancer to lose their coverage, they don't stop needing treatment. Instead, they drop out of ongoing patient care and they end up in the emergency room, significantly driving up healthcare costs. And that replaces the efficient continuous care with incredibly expensive crisis management.
A fair point as well. Dr. Nizam, thanks very much for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is Good Mornings with Chris Oakes on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
In the news business, there are two separate and distinct groups: breaking news and the news that is already broken. These are their stories.
A California man is recovering after falling into a toilet at a campsite at Shaver Lake in Fresno County, California. It's one of those vault toilets. He fell in. Apparently, he was trying to rescue his sunglasses that he had dropped inside. Ended up stuck in the toilet for about 15 minutes before first responders were able to get him out. Authorities say he had to be decontaminated, but is expected to be okay. He was able to walk away after being hosed down by firefighters. That's embarrassing. That is embarrassing. The sheriff's office did not specify whether he successfully recovered his sunglasses. I don't care. They could be the greatest sunglasses in the world. No sunglasses were that. You know what I mean? Yeah. Did you happen to see this? There's viral video of this. If you haven't seen it, a semi-truck carrying 50,000 pounds of bees overturned Sunday near Mauriceville, Texas, releasing approximately 2 million bees into the surrounding area. Orange County Emergency Services reported to the crash. The driver escaped injury, but local authorities urged nearby residents to stay indoors as the area was quickly swarmed with the 2 million escaped bees. So many of the bees attached themselves to a nearby tree that one of the limbs collapsed under all the weight. A cadre of both commercial and backyard beekeepers responded to help collect all of the bees and transport them to a local honey farm. Wow. That is, I mean, it was just crazy. If you haven't seen the video, you know, look this up online because it is absolutely crazy. Let's see here. Dumb thefts, a common theme in the broken news. And it turns out you cannot hit the jackpot by stealing a lottery ticket. According to the Volusia County Sheriff's Office in Florida, an actual lottery winner took his winning ticket into a Walmart where employees verified that it was in fact worth $2,700, but they told him you would have to cash it in at another location because of the amount and they couldn't cash it there. The customer filled out all of the paperwork but then left the ticket behind, and that's when an employee, Tamika Hall, decided to help herself to the ticket. She just grabbed it for herself. Of course, the lottery winner later went back and the ticket was gone. He called police. The cops say that Ms. Hall admitted to deputies that she left the store with the ticket and even showed them where she left it in her car. The ticket was recovered. The true winner got it back. And Ms. Hall faces charges of grand theft because of the ticket's value. It's grand theft. So not petty theft. It's grand theft. She's in big trouble. Who knew? You can't win the lottery just by stealing a ticket. No, they frown on that. And how about this? I saw this in on the Newswire. A giraffe that escaped from a Texas ranch this week has been found safe. Yeah, the bees that got loose in Texas. What's going on in Texas? Yeah, the bees that got loose, and they've got a giraffe that escaped from the Cedar Hollow Ranch has been found safe. Her name is Gracie. Cedar Hollow, by the way, is about 90 miles northwest of San Antonio. Gracie was able to get out of a gate and wandered away. But she's now safe and sound back home. It is unclear, the story says, if the $5,000 reward is what led to the capture. But I would think that that didn't hurt. But then again, I wouldn't think that a runaway giraffe would be all that hard to spot, even in Texas, you know? There can't be that too. They generally stand out from the crowd, giraffes do. You know what I mean? There you go. That is today's broken news report, an update on the odd and unusual side of the headlines. We now return you to your regularly scheduled programming.
The Riverside Civic Concert Series means great music each Wednesday night. Along with the Marathon Center for the Performing Arts, WFIN is proud to MC another season of concerts at the Band Shell at Riverside Park. This week, the Finley Civic Concert Band. Concerts are at 7 p.m. and Sunday morning at 11. We air that week's concert courtesy of Coldwell Banker Flag City. Join us on 1330 WFIN, WFIN.com, and 95.5 FM.
And now your daily download, the numbers behind the news and the statistics that shape our lives. We're talking about the rights that we have as Americans that are spelled out conceptually in the Declaration of Independence and enshrined in the Constitution. This kind of goes along with that because one of the most hotly debated rights is freedom of religion and the separation of church and state. Well, a new Pew Research Center survey reveals widespread support for religious expression in public schools. This might be a surprise or it might not, but I thought the numbers were interesting. 78% of Americans, a whopping 78%, favor voluntary student-led prayer groups. However, only 8% believe that students should be required to participate in teacher-led prayer. Now, 46% support the idea of teacher-led class prayer, but most insist that participation should remain optional. In terms of other religious expression in public schools, the survey shows 57% support the idea of coaches leading team prayers before or after sporting events. And there was an even split right down the middle, 50-50, favoring or not the display of the Ten Commandments in classrooms. 50% support the idea, and another 50% are opposed, displaying Ten Commandments in classrooms. Now, not surprisingly, Republicans generally favor these religious expressions in public school more so than Democrats. But this I thought was kind of interesting. Americans who are religiously unaffiliated, generally oppose the idea of coach-led prayer and Ten Commandments displays, but they support voluntary student prayer groups. So, kind of interesting there. And there are also regional differences geographically. You break it down geographically, there are regional differences that emerge, with Southern and Midwestern residents showing stronger support for these ideas of religious expression in public schools. Southern and Midwestern residents show stronger support than do those in the Northeast and Western states. It's not as clear cut. You would think that those who are opposed are opposed to it across the board. Not necessarily the case. And you think maybe those who are supportive of it are supportive across the board, but not necessarily the case, as the numbers reveal there. Time now to find out what's happening at the Findlay Hancock County Public Library with some hot summer reads and cool July programming. Sarah Clevidence is with us to talk about what's happening. Good morning to you. Summer read is well underway now, and you've got some stats to share on what folks are reading and how much folks are reading for the summer read program.
Yeah, we're nearing the halfway point for summer read, and at the end of week three, we had over 1,400 folks registered for summer read. They had already read nearly 6,300 books, and some of our patrons prefer to count their minutes rather than their books. Mm-hmm. So 118,000 minutes have been read already.
That is awesome. That is awesome. And the idea is to get people reading for pleasure. Anything and everything counts.
Anything and everything counts. Yep. Magazines or audiobooks.
However you want to consume great literature. And there's still time to sign up. Folks can still
absolutely
do that.
Absolutely. You can sign up at any point in the program and start reporting your reading.
Okay. So summer read continues. You do have some stuff happening in July that folks might want to put on their calendar. What's going on?
We do. And before we get to July, there's a couple things left in June even.
Okay.
So this week, Thursday, story time is at Riverside Park. Ooh. At 10 a.m.
Okay.
Do keep an eye on our website. We'll be watching the weather.
Okay.
So if rain forces that to move, that story time will just be back here at the library instead.
Okay.
And the same situation with starter story time is also at Riverside Park on Friday at 10. So keep an eye on the weather, keep an eye on our website. But fingers crossed for dry skies so we can enjoy being out at the beautiful park for both of those story time events.
Absolutely. What else is going on?
One of the big favorites with our patrons every summer is our escape room. So that's coming up in July. You'll want to mark your calendars and get signed up for that. It's July 18th and 19th. There's several different times available. The theme this year is Fossil Museum, in keeping with our dinosaur theme. So escape rooms our escape rooms are designed for grades 2 through 8. But, you know, the whole family can sign up. Mm-hmm. It's fine if older siblings join. Anybody under second grade does need to have an adult with them. But you search the museum, you solve the clues, all before time runs out.
Okay. Yeah, that's an awful lot of fun. And folks have never done the escape room things. That really is an awful lot of fun. So circle that on the calendar to be sure. What else is going on?
We are again working with Dr. Hiro Kawamura from the University of Finley to offer a Japanese cultural day in celebration of Tanabata. So if you haven't come to that before, it's a really great way to get an introduction to Japanese culture.
Okay.
And the Tanabata tree is in our lobby now. So
Tanabata, is that, do I have that right?
I hope I have it right. Okay.
What exactly is that?
So it's a Japanese star festival.
Oh, okay.
And there is a tradition of writing wishes on colorful strips of paper and then hanging them on the Tanabata tree. So our patrons have been already hanging their wishes on the tree. They'll do more of that during the program, learn a little bit more about other aspects of Japanese culture. But it's always so enjoyable to read some of those wishes that have been hung up.
That does sound cool. That would be a tradition that we should adopt in this country. So find out more about that. What is the date on that again?
That one is July 1st.
Okay, so that's coming up next week.
That one and the escape room you do need to register for, finleylibrary.org. You can find the registrations on our calendar.
All right. Very good. Anything else to highlight in the month of January, the month of July coming up?
You're just channeling that cool weather because it's supposed to be really hot. And you know I've got to get my annual joke in of the library is the cool place to be
when
the temperatures go up.
That's right.
So there's lots happening all throughout the month of July. Story times continue. Weekly, we'll have our weekly makerspace for that tween age group. The one next week is Ozobot Robots, which is always a lot of fun for the kids. We've got book discussions for adults, book bingos coming up again on July 20th, crafter work for some backyard bird embroidery July 29th.
Okay. A lot of things.
A little something for everyone.
Yeah, a lot of things going on to keep you busy in the month of July, and especially for the kids when they start to get the I'm boards, when they've had enough summer vacation, something to keep them active and keep their minds busy. We mentioned summer read, and obviously summertime, a great time for big beach reads and you know all of that. If folks are looking for something to add to their summer reading list, what's new?
Yeah, I've got a couple of highly anticipated titles coming out in July.
Okay.
There's the Romance Revival by Christina Loren. So this one's a contemporary romance. Scientist Emery Finch has surprised her friends and family by doing something completely out of character. She got married. You know, it was easy to fall in love with Luca, but she's found that married life hasn't been as easy as she thought. She works in a research facility on cutting-edge technology, highly classified, and it demands a lot of her time.
Interesting.
She can't explain to Luca why she has to spend so much of her time on that work, and it started to create a rift in their marriage. So she's on her way to meet Luca for dinner one evening when she tragically witnesses him being hit by a car. Luca dies before help can arrive. Without thinking of the consequences, Emery gives Luca the experimental compound that she's been developing that will bring him back to life.
Whoa, there's a twist I didn't see coming.
Right? So the challenge is Luca does not remember her when he is revived. Their magnetic chemistry is still there, and Emery is determined not to waste the second chance at true love.
Wow. Very good. Very good. That would be a good beach read, I would imagine. It's good stuff.
Yeah. Now, if you want something a little more intense, perhaps, The Country Road Murders by James Patterson and Mike Lupica. Shocking accident ended Silas Tucker's legendary football career. Humbled, he returns home to Cross Rivers, North Carolina to start a new life for himself on what's left of his family's struggling farm. But the town that Silas returns to is in complete chaos. There's a gang known as Southern Mafia that's taken over. They're trafficking drugs, committing murders, and the town citizens are terrified. The police are desperate for help. With nothing left to lose, Silas and his best friend Taylor decide it's time to take back their town and serve up some vigilante justice. So that one publishes on July 13th. There is a holds list available. James Patterson's titles are always very popular.
Yeah, with our patrons. Good stuff. Again, Sarah Klevidens with the Findlay Hancock County Public Library with us this morning talking about things going on in July. As we mentioned, hot reads and cool programs at the library in the upcoming month. We've got a link on our webpage for more information. And Sarah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that will finish up our podcast for today. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us on the program this morning. Once again, a reminder, you can get more information about all of the topics that we talk about each and every day on the show at our webpage. Check us out online at goodmornings.net. Also, if you're a regular listener to the podcast, we would appreciate it if you would take a moment or two to leave us a rating or review on your favorite podcasting platform to help others discover the show as well. We thank you very much. Coming up tomorrow morning on the program, Raise the Bar Hancock County continues to earn recognition for their workforce development programs. Plus, Senator John Husted joins us to discuss the recently passed housing measure and his bill aimed at keeping private businesses private. So until tomorrow morning, that is Good Mornings for this morning. Now that you've had a good morning, go on out and make it a good day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.